Welcome to Headstand. This is Patrick Widdis with you for the next hour. We started with the Wise Guys mixing up some old school beats. That was Search's End. The usual mix of music and spoken word tonight, including poetry from Ross Sutherland, a recording he did for the show a couple of years ago, which I've dug out of the archives. That's coming up later on Cambridge 105.
This is not a media hype. This is not a media hype. sprinkles his love on me. He's the scientist and teaching, preaching. Come on, question me. I have the answer to the master plan. If you can, then I can.
That was Filthy by Saint Etienne, the Monkey Mafia remix. This is Ian Ketekou.
Because she was left-handed, she was left-handed. A wooden stake up her spine in a cloak of self-fluid colored flames as they claimed she was a sorcerer. Left right over an oval aura of odor, this sickening stench of sizzling skin, it's disgusting. The order to have her life left right over, cause she chose left over right now, her spirit's right over what's left over of her charred corpse looking like some meatloaf leftovers. It's disgusting. It wasn't that long ago when young children were killed for using this hand. Beaten into orthodoxy or tied, left behind back or left behind back of the class because they were different. But this systemic, systematic subjugation of those with a non-sequential processing style is deep-seated in our semantics, such as in Latin. where the word for left is sinister, or in Greek scales meaning awkward, in French ghost translating to clumsy, in Hindi ultra haneth meaning wrong hand, in German leaks meaning weak, in Portuguese canhoto, a word once used to identify the devil. In West Africa, they will not eat with you if you use your left. I've been slapped around more times than I can count for using this hand. They claim you should only clean and wipe your ass with the left, right, and eat with your right. But I got it all mixed up, so no wonder why I talk so much shit. 10% of the average population, but die on average 10 years earlier than our right-handed counterparts from accidents like scissors, fridges, cars, bridges, roads, knives, saws, ridges. And in a world of right angles, we have trained our minds to think outside of the box. We are the architects, mathematicians, musicians, Mensa members, and cricket players. Profiles of prisoners, predators, pedophiles, and political pundits. 5 out of the last 7 American presidents. 4 out of the 5 makers of the Macintosh computer. 1 in 4 Apollo astronauts. You might think it's crazy. It is. We have a disproportionate disposition to mental illness like stuttering and schizophrenia, stuttering and schizophrenia, stuttering. Hey, who the hell's over there in that vocal booth? Prone to dyslexia. So I found myself writing sentences that make the same sense forward as they do backwards, like, live not on evil. They say that you should know your rights, but I know my lefts like Einstein, Newton, Beethoven, Gandhi, Napoleon, Caesar, Aristotle, Joan of Arc, Hendrix, Mark Twain, Lewis Carroll, Nietzsche, Helen Keller, Olsen twins, and the list goes on. Do you know what it feels like to have every love poem you've ever written erased the moment you wrote it because it's smudged? Because we are left to right, not right to left, except in Iran, a country left of our political right, where they write right to left, not left to right. But here, to write right to left is wrong, to write left to right is right, so I left to write wrongs, 2 lefts make a right, 2 rights make a left, 2 wrongs don't make a right, and being left doesn't make you wrong, just because it doesn't make you right, I swear. This is for the charismatic, iconoclastic cats who can't catch a clear-cut case of non-cold conversation because they claim we were classless, like school on Sunday. But someday, those individuals will realize that only left-handed people are in their right mind. Someone better tell these jokers that life is not like a game of cards. There was no such thing as a wrong hand. And if being left is wrong, I don't want to be right. I'll be glad to be the only one left.
That's Left Hand from the album Lessons from Planet Earth, Re-Evolution by Ian Ketekou, who apart from being left-handed is a writer, performance poet and a World Poetry Slam champion. If you want to get in touch, you can email headstand@cambridge105.fm. You can tweet me at Patrick Widdis or join the Facebook group Headstand on Cambridge 105. This is the Spaghetti Faction.
Unexpected item in the bagging area. There's an unexpected item in my bagging area. I don't know how it got there. I didn't put it there. It's not even my bagging area. I didn't put the machine here. I wanted a human being, not a machine. The machines came and the checker out has receded, and then the unexpected item in my bagging area came. I don't know what unexpected item in my bagging area is. It won't tell me. I have to press another button. The light's on the end of the thin, the leash your beacon starts to flash. A warning to the world. A signal to those behind me in the front of the queue of just how incompetent I am at shopping. Why doesn't he just remove the unexpected item and get on with it so we can get back to our BLTs and our Diet Cokes and our Pringles? I don't know what to do, I'm paralysed. I know that if I do anything, then I'll do stuff. Stuff like screaming and shouting and slamming and mad-eyed, blood-eyed, smashing, consumption-driven cultural icons and technology with my puny fists. Like a rockin', sockin', boxing robot with Parkinson's disease. So I don't, instead I wait for the woman. There's an unexpected item in my bagging area, Mrs. There's an unexpected item in my bagging area. She used to be a checker-out, but now she's a self-service checkout supervisor. She okays her bottle of sangria with an alcoholic content level lower than most bloody shandies. Unexpected item in my bagging area. Unexpected item in my bagging area. Push the button. Yes, I do have my own bag. No, I don't have a loyalty card. should know best of rage against the machine. No, I don't think any little helps. Yes, I am waiting for assistance. Unexpected item in my bagging area. There's an unexpected item in my bagging area, darling. I stop, I expel air loudly, I look behind me and I shrug. What the, what can I give a tight smile of embarrassment and turn around? Unexpected item in the bagging area. Unexpected item in the bagging area. I press another button and the machine speaks to me. Does anyone expect full employment in an era of neoliberalism? Ah, gosh, of course not. Well, you shall just have to wait until the economy grows sunshine. This is very natural and sensible, isn't it? I press no. That's not a viable option. Press any other button. There are two options. Yes and oh yes. Yes and oh yes. Yes and oh yes. I wait for further assistance. Unexpected item in the bagging area. I wait, but the queue can't wait anymore. And two pinstripe suits in the back of the line rush me. They start lashing me with the rolled up copies of The Economist. I defend myself with my thin 12-page Morning Star. But to no avail, I'm beaten back and restrained. And then they force my palm down onto the oh yes button. And I relent. And I concede. And I press, oh yes, oh yes, oh yes. Unexpected anarchist in the bagging area. Unexpected anarchist in the bagging area.
Unexpected item in the bagging area, a phrase which in a few short years has gone from meaningless to everyday phrase. And now poetry, thanks to the Spaghetti Faction. That's from the album Comrade Amigo. I quite like those self-service checkouts myself. The one in W.H. Smith gave me a roll of wrapping paper for 1p just before Christmas. Coming up, we've got Ross Sutherland, some poetry from him. This is Leserita Mitsuko. was Someone to Love by Les Rita Mitsuko. Now for about the next 20 minutes on Cambridge 105, we have poetry and comedy from Ross Sutherland. Recorded back in 2009, I'm delighted to rebroadcast this. Enjoy.
Hiya, thanks very much. I had a gig in Brighton Pier about 2 weeks ago, and so I tried to write a joke for it, because it was going to dope a squally country after all. So I thought I'd start off with the joke I wrote. It goes like this. I say. My wife is ugly. So ugly, in fact, that she is like the rancid chest wound on a soldier from the Napoleonic War. By which, of course, I mean banned from public display under the 1824 Vagrancy Act. Yeah. That joke is funny as hell if you like take it away and research it a bit. I'm going to start off with a poem about Switzerland. Switzerland is, you know, in my head, is famous for two reasons. It's famous because it's the kind of birthplace of Dadaism. It's also kind of become more famous for euthanasia in recent time. I've got a great quote from a politician from a Swiss parliament, Dorla Valenda, who said this: tourists come at lunchtime and by the afternoon they are dead. That's a direct quote. So this is called, by the time you read this, I will be in Switzerland. There have been so many corridors, and taxi drivers, and ears, and fees, and men from White Knight Insurance, but now comes the time. Now, as the seatbelts fasten, the Alps gouging the cloud cover, now, all that remains of the world is Zurich. Home to the biggest clock face in Europe. Home to black truffles, bittersweet and peaceful evenings. Home to Tina Turner for the last 19 years. Where gentlemen sit down to pee between 10 and 6 a.m. It is heaven. It's a kind of place where you stop for a day and stay forever, says Joe Ritchie, American entrepreneur who lives in Geneva but visits Zurich often. Litter doesn't even seem to touch the ground. We buy matching Cabaret Voltaire Swatch watches, 70 francs. On the strap, a quote from Kurt Schwitters: immortality is not everybody's thing. Down in the hotel's dar bar, tourists listen back to a recording of Hugo Ball, cheering when he is manhandled off stage, lost in a maze of his own irony. In our room, the chairs are nailed to the ceiling. We sit on the bed and watch some TV, a dubbed transmission of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, until Uncle Phil dissolves into illogical phonetics. Across town, 12 Giacometti statues are carefully positioned to avoid each other's eye contact. Old men play giant chess amongst the trees in Lindenhof Square. At 7, the lobster rings. Apparently, our longing for death has been sufficiently consistent for the authorities. We have an address in Kilkberg and a time. There is to be a coffee machine and some champagne glasses and a collection of walking sticks, which we're welcome to add to. We're seriously advised not to arrive early. A woman in the lobby informs us of a performance of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring this evening. But we don't go. For dinner, we have veal steak, accompanied by sautéed vegetables and galettes, a dessert of rhubarb and strawberry charlotte. Before I lived in Cambridge, I lived in Newcastle for 6 months. I was I was sort of right in residence for a theatre up there, but so I was going to watch plays and write poems about it, and it was great. It was the best job I ever had, really. But the theatre went into liquidation 2 months before the end of my contract. It happened overnight. It was really, really sudden. But I was still paid from another source, so I actually spent 2 months as a writer in residence for an abandoned building. So this was a theatre in the Usborn Valley in Newcastle, if anyone knows it. And this is called Poet in Residence for a Theatre in Liquidation. They said they knew it was dying. A month, maybe more. They held it in. Kept the teeth at the front, kept polishing its glasses, whistling Frank Lurser as the basement flooded. Everything we do is a warning sign. Only last week, I stood in the office admonishing printers and saw those filing cabinets teetering on the fire escape, thinking I wouldn't mind going that way myself, which was close to the truth, but not close enough. Last night, it was Aesop's fables. Grandchildren waddled into their childhoods. The counters smelt of branches and fixative. 10 years later, someone is remembering it. It happened at 22:34, the manager stepped out to make a phone call. That was all the time it needed. Today, the sun bounced from Bedford Van Bonnets. I sat and watched as men in trim blue uniforms reassembled the theatre out on the lawn. Summer began to feel like an elaborate set design. Only movement broke the stillness. Inside, the front of house pushed uncomfortably through the halls, as if the architecture had turned against them. I found a rail of clothes, accumulated over 9 months of rushed get-outs, a paisley waistcoat, a bike helmet, a t-shirt that said Dan, and I must admit, I wish I'd tried harder, written more poems under the arches of that converted stable yard. Not even good ones. That's not the point. And not about the plays either. More about those still waiting for their cue, circulating in the wings, sick with prescience. This tender world of transformation that can cut out at any time. The fire exits leading us out under the shadow of the viaduct. The applause of the trains above us. The moon up in the cheap seat. Just another retired actor. Heaven's rig jabbing the Usborn River. Decontaminated. But running backwards. I wrote 10 poems about getting naked. That sounds excessive, right? But only the first one's really about a person being naked, and then all the subsequent ones are about other things being naked. So I thought maybe I've got 2 of them here. So the first one's about a person, and then I'll read one about a naked university. House DJs always keep their hair short, so their heads can be easily cut from press shots, then dropped onto fluorescent posters, and a thousand other reasons to be clean-cut and rhythmical, to drip dry after the morning shower, when our signal-to-noise ratio is at its peak. A teacher once told me that poetry aspires to the simplicity of the nude. To be naked, he said, is to speak without footnotes. Although, in my opinion, a naked person usually has more explaining to do than anyone. I am sitting on your toilet with my empty notepad. You are drying your fake tan with a hairdryer, talking to me through the bathroom mirror, asking if the back of you matches the front. And I can't even hazard a guess. Questions like this make me feel like a child, listening to the roar of static behind the curtains, the endless transmission of London too powerful to appear within my limited bandwidth. Your body is too much. London is too much. I can barely connect 2 parts of it. The diagrams we use are useless upon the surface. It's in these moments that I realise how little my A to Z has to do with the alphabet, and how uneven the spread of language has become, its edges collapsing into farce, fizzing with data like nudist beaches. which is why I write down, I am in love with your neck, which is why I cut the body into pieces. So this is a naked uni. Our architect is famed for identical buildings. The School of Broken Necks in Toronto. The Yahtzee Institute in Bethlehem. One bleached white, the other grey. Ours famously fluctuating between the two. With hockey teams slamming their ochre girlfriends against its dim corridors. Its basements humming with password-protected short stories. Young minds so deep inside the library that the very act of standing up would be like unplugging the lake with all earthly knowledge rushing out through the hole they'd left behind. But if a legend is correct, and the higher functions of a university are built around an ancient reptilian brain, then surely this is it. A closed burger van, chronicling the evening's takings. The last member of an improv group, selecting Iron Maiden for the journey home. Trainee nurses swinging their arms under the sepia of the streetlights. The hold music of the sky. Oh, I think, you know, there are always certain people, we all know them, that will always comically misinterpret the brief. I'm thinking of that kind of thing that kind of starts in childhood when you kind of get to the age maybe when you first start noticing girls who, you know, you get guys that come into school one day and they'll just suddenly be like wearing something weird, trying to draw attention to themselves. You know, they'll come in wearing like one golfing glove, you know, or they'll have like some sort of story which is just obviously not true, like, oh, my parents died in the Titanic. And, you know, like, and I think some people, like, carry that through into adult life. I don't, you know, like, I'm not, like, I don't hate exhibitionists at all. Like, I really, obviously, like, I can't understand that. But, you know, it's genetically, you kind of makes total sense, isn't it? I mean, you've got this kind of herd of wildebeests, you know, like, and then, you know, like, and they're all competing for attention. And then one day, one of the wildebeests turns up wearing a golfing glove, you know. And then, like, the kind of lady wildebeest looks at the guy and goes, wow, you know, like, that guy stands out from the crowd. I'll mate with that wildebeest, and then my children will have the genetic advantages of wearing a golfing glove on one hand for no reason. But, you know, I think some people will always, you know, will try and stand out, you know, by comically misinterpreting the brief. I've got a guy, my friend Dave, who, you know, will always go to a fancy dress party, and will always hilariously reinterpret what the fancy dress party is meant to be about. So I wrote this for Dave. It's called Themes. Theme number one. The theme of the party is Pat Butcher. I have come as Malibu Pat. In the toilet queue, I get chatting to a nice girl in rally fatigues. She plays with one of her earrings. She has come as NASCAR Pat. The phone rings. Phone call for Pat. We both laugh. At midnight, one Frank turns up. He is instantly mobbed by Pat. Hey, she says, it's Dave. He's come as Frank. 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 Dave waggles his spectacles at me. I tear off my garland and throw it on the floor. Number two. The theme of the party is the adversaries of General Victoriano Huerta. Most of us have come as Emiliano Zapata, obviously, or Francesco Maduro, posing for black and white photographs by the fountain. At 12, I hear the sound of someone riding a horse through our plastic orange grove. Suddenly, Dave appears, dressed as Jose Guerrero, a brace of shot glasses strung across his chest. Another Zapata turns to me. This is funny because Huerta died of cirrhosis of the liver. Bueno, says Dave, pulling out a bueno. sorry about that. Several women swoon over the edge of the balustrade and have to be resuscitated. I remove their moustaches before the ambulance arrives. Number three, the theme of the party is the Fibonacci sequence. I have been handing out paper hats cut into Fermat spiral. We dance all night. Harmonic intervals going up. Melodic intervals going down. Several guests witness Dave flickering across the ceiling, yelling something about being crashed by randoms. His eyes were incredible, said one guest. Looking into them felt like being Rickrolled. Number four. The theme of the party is typos in the Declaration of Independence. I spend all day constructing the bonfire for my all men are cremated Beatles. At midnight, Dave appears in the form of a giant face-shaped cloud. I don't get it, I say to Linda, but this only makes her laugh louder. Number five. Number five, the final party, my party. The theme of the party is Dave. The kitchen is Dave. The bathroom is Dave. I Dave up the Dave until it is Dave. Everybody thinks it's very funny. We wait for midnight. Disposable cameras at the ready. The door cracks. We hold our breath as a squeaky, pimpled dog toy bounces across the threshold, followed by a jackknife truck of frozen bees, a dead football team, the Opus Dei, gallows, a piñata full of blood, the Samoans, all the Samoans, the stock market crash, a fracture unit, St. Thomas of Kent, habits, psychic advice, pimps and prostitutes, a hand the size of a courtyard, a gay cyberman, a bodyguard with money to burn, a clown tied to a chair, a consensus of failure, a hell dimension Kiora advert, crypto-monarchists following, reconstructivists following, the unreasonably chipper, the International Guild of Diet Coke Men, the horizontal, the vertical, the heart broke, the cabbaged, Moorfield's eye hospital, a goose, a global outpouring of rainforest, fog cubes, spider patrols, coffin-coloured Mars colonists, unicorn grandads, mercurial twats, resurrected slogans, pregnant support staff, and then eventually at the back of the conga, us, we see ourselves entering the party, one hand raised and waggling. Dave, we screamed in agony. Dave, you've done it again. Thanks very much.
Goodbye, cruel world, it's all sewn up. You've got it made and I'm out of love. Take it for another day. someone call me up, the number's in the book. But if I'm gonna do this thing, it's you too.
Headstand on Cambridge 105. That was What a Way to End It All by Deaf School, following Ross Sutherland, recorded for a show in 2009. Ross is a founding member of Aisle 16, and another member of that collective, Luke Wright, has a new album out. It's called We're All in This Together, and this is the ballad of Mr. and Mrs. P. Cartwright, which I should warn you contains some strong language.
Hello there. What have we here? A ballad? My, what fun! I like the way they tend to go, da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. They're solid and predictable, like Little Harping On. And Little Harping On is where this ghastly tale unfolds. You know the sort of place I mean? It's got a church, it's old, where barber, argas, trollop sagas and tipsy jams are sold. The sort of little country place that London folk find pretty. So Kirsty helps them find a house at prices that are silly. Well, Phil sets out to track them down a crash pad in the city, close to the bars and restaurants that they love. It's here and Little Harping On, the Cartwrights got all homey. Their third car was a Land Rover to tow their daughter's pony. They used to vote Conservative, but then they switched to Tony. And blow me, before you knew it, the kids had flown the nest. The Cartwrights watched them graduate, dressed in their Sunday best. Jemima's having babies now, and Rue's at RBS. Predictably, retirement came, the firm threw Peter Dew. The chairman made a lovely speech, which touched them through and through. And here Mrs. Cartwright left to explore new avenues. Her life became as golden as a Richard Curtis rom-com. She'd potter in the garden while he'd test drive with his tom-tom and say to neighbours as he passed, "Great bit of kit this, you got one." Mere weeks into their reverie, Jemima came to call. "Enjoy your golden handshake, Dad, just don't spend it all. Do you know, when this place is mine, I might take down that wall, get a windmill in the garden, take the place off-grid. Sorry, Mum, what's that? The china? Think I'll just get rid. Shit, I'm late for Pilates, will you mind the kids?" And with that, the yummy mummy went and left her parents reeling. Seconds later, Rupert entered, jabbing at the ceiling. "You want to keep an eye on this? I've got a nasty feeling there might be structural damage here, and I won't pay the bill. It's awfully tough at RBS. I only got a mil. Oh, yeah, and by the way, old boy, need to see the will. Might need some of my bit now. Could he work some trick? I've got some poor bitch up the spuff. Need to get a fix, but not right now. Got a dash, so maybe fax me at Irwin. Here's the leaflet for that home." He gave his dad a poke. "Your heart could pack up any dent. She's prime for a stroke. Just promise you'll consider it." And with that, Rue left his folks. Peter Cartwright sighed and said, "We knew this day would come. I think they call it karma after what we did to Mum. Camilla Pudding, please don't cry. Trust me, they'll get none." Behind his specs, his cruel eyes slimmed. He banged his palsied fist. "Yes, darling, fetch the Bollinger. Let's get really pissed. Grab that pad of Basil and Bond. Let's make a shopping list. Massage tables, exercise bike, a Botox for our faces, a suit for me, a hat for you, a weekend at the races. Golly, this bolly folly's jolly. Let's buy a few more cases. A cottage in the Hebrides. Shall we buy a country pub? We could hire an alcoholic chef to make the usual grub and slowly drink the profits of the places boarded up. Let's go trekking in the Andes. Shall we get a boat? I could run for Parliament. I doubt I'll get the votes, but I hear the PR's very dear. Let's at least get a quote." So, Mr. and Mrs. P. Cartwright flashed their reckless streak as branded Luton vans arrived with gadgets and antiques. Expensive hobbies were began and abandoned in a week. The children's former bedrooms housed flutes they never played, plus dusty golf clubs, dinner sets, racing bikes and lathes. You've heard of affluenza, right? Well, this was AffluAIDS, a raging, rampant visa virus they hoped was terminal, though every month their spirits sank when Pete's accountant called to cheerily reassure them that they hadn't spent it all. And though they tried their utmost, their credit wouldn't taper. The Cartwrights were quite comfortable a year into their caper, until one morning Pete let out a shriek over the paper. "Camilla, look, it says right here, Ruse Bank is at the limit. It says it's staffed by nincompoops whose policies are gimmicks. It's going under any day. Hey, let's throw our money in it." An anxious 30 minutes passed, then Pete put down the phone. The broker needed talking round. I didn't like his tone, but eventually he saw sense. Our legacy is blown. Hours later, the bank went down. The media made a fuss. Interviewing blokes like Rue, who just said, "Don't blame us. The Treasury should have bailed us out. Do you know, it's darn ridiculous." As repo men in cheap grey suits went from floor to floor, the Cartwrights clinked their champagne flutes and let off loud guffaws till, when the place had emptied out, they shut the kitchen door and walked through Little Harpingham for several voiceless hours, stopping every now and then to pick each other flowers. Then, when the sunset fell on them, they climbed the church's tower. Then shoeless on the battlement, half lit by orange light, Peter and Camilla Cartwright stood as man and wife till, after many minutes there, they stepped into the night. But hold it, folks, don't shed your tears. This wasn't suicide. The old church tower in Harpington is 34 foot high. Those cunning, spendthrift baby boomers were only paralysed. And in hospital for decades more, the Cartwrights lay quite still, which meant that no one knew if they'd intended to be killed, though Rupert swore they winked at him when he came to pay their bill.
I imagine that poem illustrated by Quentin Blake. Marvellous, revolting. That's A Ballad of Mr. and Mrs. P. Cartwright by Luke Wright. This is Bach's Prelude and Fugue in G major.
Thank you.
That was Bach's Prelude and Fugue in G Major, played by James Kibbe, who has undertaken to record Bach's complete organ works on some magnificent German organs. You can listen to all the recordings and find information about the organs on blockmrecords.org. You've been listening to Headstand with Patrick Widdis, and it's nearly time for me to hand over to Robert Louis Abrahamson in the studio in Cambridge. Don't forget, you can contact me on headstand@cambridge105.fm, and I'd particularly like to hear from you if you have any music or spoken word you'd like to contribute. I'll leave you with a DJ based in Osaka, Ian Hansley. He records under the name Enna, that's E-N-H. This is Nan Madal. Good night. Thank you.
Thank you.